Working? Yeah, there we go. So why don't we get back to work? So we'll do another hour session and another 15-minute break and final half hour if we need it. Making good progress, so we'll see. So up to now, I've been talking about the part of the compiler that just checks whether the program seems to be valid or not. At this stage, we have to say, well, we just didn't want to check validity. We wanted to actually get something that implements what the program represents. So we have to have components that translate what each structure means. And this is something where we'll take each particular structure and give you sequences of code, in this case, at the Java virtual machine level, that implement what we have. But that means we have some intuitive notion of what programs do. And in fact, in implementing a language, we have to have some notion of what is a loop. You've programmed enough, you probably have some notion of it, but this notion of something repeating over and over again is not entirely natural until you learn programming. In fact, people talk, as I was talking earlier, about an infinite loop, a loop which never voluntarily terminates. And that really does seem problematic. And yet, we started to expand what our meaning of programs is to contain things which, in theory, run forever. Now, of course, nothing is forever. But there's a difference between expecting something to stop and knowing that, being a physical entity, it will have to stop at some point for reasons beyond its control, perhaps. So in the AST, that's a syntax tree. And now what we're going to have to do is at some point translate into a structure that represents what the execution of a program might be. And what we'll oftentimes do is instead of going directly to machine code, which is actually what we'll do because we only have a finite amount of time, is that it's possible to translate to an intermediate form that says, I don't care what machine you run on, but here's a representation of what the machine ought to do. And if I execute it, it'll produce an output which will mimic what the specification of the program is. So we're talking here about generating a high-level intermediate representation that captures the notion of a program. So to kind of show you that, you might have something like, and if B, A equals 1. And we translate that down to an abstract syntax tree. I've shown you that. And at some point, we have to say, what does this actually mean in terms of execution? And one way to translate this would be to something that takes components of a program and evaluates them. How do you evaluate a B? Well, it's not clear until I know what B is. B could be a named constant, in which case I need no evaluation at all, or it could be the name of a variable. The thing about variables is they can be placed in many different positions. They could be right on my processor. They could be somewhere back in the virtual memory the system has. They could be out in my local net. They could be out in the cloud. And in a lot of cases, getting a piece of data and evaluating it is non-trivial. And yet we want to, in terms of our specification, saying, I don't care how you do it at this stage. That will depend on the exact definition of B and how it's implemented on your particular computer in your particular environment. And that changes. How data is fetched makes a big difference. In these days, the most common way is to be able to get data from an electronic circuit, as you, for example, a flash memory or electronic memory in a computer. But of course, in old days, things were very different. Where you got data from might be something like a punched card. And you've seen those old examples of punched cards. In earlier machines, there are actually cases where you may have heard people talk about computer memory as core memory. And in fact, on certain systems, when you have a failure, the contents of your memory is dumped. And that's sometimes called dumping core. And on many computers, the file is actually called core, C-O-R-E. Does anybody know what that core refers to? Once upon a time, it was very important. Now it's wholly historic. What happens in the old days, memory was implemented by tiny little bits of magnetic material. Think of it as donuts, but donuts very, very tiny, smaller than a head of a pin. And people would actually weave wires through the hole in the donut. And what would happen is that donut would be magnetized up or down, plus or minus, based on the current going through those lines. And the way you would get a piece of data is you would sense the magnetic state of those cores, those little tiny donuts, and read it back. Those are much more limited in space. They're much more expensive. And actually, there were people in developing countries, India, for example, that actually weaved computer cores the way a person might have weaved a sweater or a pants or a suit or something. So what we want to do is get away from the details at the stage of figuring out exactly how you implemented B, but we want to evaluate it. And what you would then do is say, well, this is a conditional. So it just says, if this is true, I want to do something. How do we know that? Well, we have this notion that a Boolean can be tested. The then statement is if the Boolean is true, and the else statement, if we have one, is if it's false. It's legal to have a then without an else, and this says, conditionally, I may or may not do the assignment. So what this thing would say is, if false, skip. And what is it you skip? Well, what you skip is the then statement, because if it's false, you don't do it. So this is starting to get some sense of there's an actual dynamic execution component, that here there's this notion of skipping, going someplace or not, which is fundamental to computing. Here would this be evaluate one, which is probably pretty trivial because a constant is very easy to evaluate, and then store in A. And again, that may be easy or not depending on where we've chosen to put A. But we start to do translations of this sort, saying here's a higher level representation and there's a lower level one. This is not fully implemented yet because we don't know exactly the capabilities of our machine. We don't know necessarily where various data structures are placed. That might be something that the compiler does. It might be something the operating system does. It may be something that the runtime system does. So something that we have to determine later. So that's why we have that phase, to separate the translation to an understandable executable form, and later we'll do it to a form that a machine can really execute. This is still a little too obscure in terms of giving the details of how to actually execute the program. We may or may not want to optimize. There's always this question when we have programs that run faster and faster, computers that run faster and faster, whether optimization is a dead issue. Turns out it's not, because no matter how fast our computer is, it's never fast enough, it kind of seems. I was just commenting to somebody that I have a brand new PowerBook here, MacBook Air, I should say, PowerBook, MacBook Air, latest and greatest. And yet it was the case that when I was going from full screen mode to non-full screen mode, it took maybe 10 or 15 seconds. And it just doesn't seem like it ought to be that long. So it seems somewhere in the code that goes from full screen mode to not, there's something going on that could be skipped. Just doesn't seem as necessary. So there's a potential for optimization. So we won't talk much about this in detail, but we will talk about in passing that one of our temptations, or perhaps even one of our goals, is to not just translate programs, but translate them to effective and efficient code. The faster computers get, the less important that seems, but the faster computers get, the more we want our machine to do. So if you want it to do more, a good way to get that is to do more in an effective manner, an efficient manner. One of the interesting things about computing is that there are interesting questions, profound questions, that come up quite unexpectedly. And that's not always the case that people believe that. As an undergraduate, I was a physics major. And I had an undergraduate advisor, an old German fellow. And I got accepted into graduate school, Cornell University, Ivy Leagues. Ooh, cool. I got in there. And I was happy as could be. And I went to my advisor and says, I've gotten accepted into Cornell. His eyes got wide, in computer science. And his face dropped. And he looked at me and he says, but that's programming. And it was the only time in my life that programming became a four-letter word. So it's a situation there where I really thought that it was something, that to be attained, but something that he did not necessarily believe in. But there are profound things, and if I would have known enough computing at that time to tell him, I could have really impressed him with some of the subtleties involved. For example, oftentimes we ask about a program, is it right or wrong? Okay, that makes sense. Obviously, those are hard questions. But it turns out that there are certain questions in computing One of those is variations on is it right or wrong that are impossible. I mean, literally impossible to answer. One of the ones we care about is what I touched on earlier. Namely, I'll give you a complete specification of a program in any language you want. I'll give you all the data it will read, access, touch. And all you have to tell me is whether the program will stop or not. Now, of course, in many programs, it's easy to tell. For example, if there's no loops, the program will execute and hit the bottom of the program and be done. But any reasonable program has a loop, or they might have recursion which simulates a loop, so it's not quite that easy. And it turns out that theoretical computer scientists can prove to you that certain questions like, does a program terminate? Or even simpler, I can point to a statement in a program and say, is that statement ever used? Notice if it's not used, I can throw it away. If it is used, I better not. Even that one, you cannot answer it in general. Now, I need a theoretical class to kind of explain it. It's not that hard. But it turns out under very reasonable assumptions, you can show that if I assume that it is possible to determine whether a program stops or not, I could lead to a logical contradiction. The result of that has to be the assumption that I can tell for any program, does it stop or not, is an impossible request. I cannot write such a program. Saying something, that's funny. I mean, what happens really, what it gets down to, is that programs may take an arbitrarily long amount of time, but they may eventually stop. I'm sure some of you have been in a situation I have where I've got a program running and it's downloading something or that, and I'm just ready to kill the thing because I'm sure something has died. And just as I'm reaching for the button, it flicks and says, done, and everything's installed. So a lot of times you think something's not going to terminate, but it does. It's just taking longer than expected. So there really are some profound things. And again, optimization, there's some questions you can ask, can I do this optimization, that are really impossible to do. Turns out there are other issues. There are some questions I can answer, but turn out to be so difficult that's probably not worth my while to try to come up with a complete answer. But as computers are getting faster and faster and more numerous, that may change. One of them that I'm sure you have contact with, directly or indirectly, is something called the traveling salesman problem. This is not a compiling problem, but it is a computing problem. And it simply says, here are a list of cities you have to visit. Here are the routes that you can go from here to there or there to there, and some measure of expense. It might be how many dollars it costs the company, or how many miles, or how much time it takes. And all you have to do is figure out the best route. I have to visit here, 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 and there, but not in any particular order. But I have to visit them, and I want to visit them in the least costly or the fastest or most energy efficient, whatever it is, way. The problem with this is the best known algorithm is really reduced down to trying all combinations. But as you have more and more destinations, trying all combinations gets tougher and tougher. Just imagine if you had 20. Now, hopefully you don't get 20, but if you're going to Europe or something, you know, and visiting every place, you might have 20 destinations. The first time, you get any one of the 20, so that's 20. Your second one is 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 14. And that product, when you have 20 numbers that high, gets pretty big. If you have a computer in front of you, you can get it. But so big that trying all those may not be feasible. Similar things happen in computing, where you can say, how should I lay out a program? I can put this here and that there and that there. And in many cases, the only algorithm that people know for sure is right is trying all the combinations. And if there are too many combinations, that may not be possible, may be too costly in terms of time. So in many cases, something I'd like to do optimally, that is the best possible, I may have to settle for something called a heuristic, which is something that usually works pretty good, but isn't guaranteed to be absolutely perfect. So there's some substance here, and I wish my old professor was still around now that I'm an old professor, and I got to tell them that I didn't make such a dumb decision after all. Yeah, question? You have to speak louder, I can't. Oh, yeah, that's a technical term. It's mathematicians use, and it means non-deterministic polynomial. Forget about it. Just think of it as somebody's initials. So, you know, nothing to probe or something, whatever there. It's just a term. So when I teach this course to undergraduates, sometimes they've taken the course. And if I don't put that up there, says, oh, I know what that is. I know what that is. And then it says, I have to show them that the prof is not as dumb as he looks. He's just as dumb as he acts. So Sorry about that, but I could explain it to you, but it's just the terminology that's developed. But the takeaway is doing translation correctly is very hard, in some cases impossible, so we have to become engineers. Now, in some cases, that's fine, in some cases, not. Computer scientists love to be scientists. Being scientist is good, you know. What am I, a rocket scientist? You know, oh, no, I'm just a computer scientist. But sometimes you say, more of what we're doing is engineering rather than science. And that's not bad. Actually, engineering is a very, very underappreciated aspect of daily life. Much of the reason we live a good life is because engineers have done the hard job. I mean, just look at this beautiful computer. It's the engineers who figured out how to put all this computing power in this tiny little beautiful package. And I bless their hearts for having done it because it's a wonderful little device. Way, way better than I ever expected. If when I was graduating from college, somebody said I would have a machine like this available for less than a month's pay, I would never have believed it. But it worked out that way, so it was cool. The final step is something that you will implement. You won't have to do the optimizer. You won't actually have to even do the translator. We'll kind of wind it all together. Is you'll have to do a code generator that says, here are the instructions for the machine that we're going to use. We're going to use something called a Java virtual machine designed to support Java. CSX is like Java, so that's a good match. And it will go ahead and say, here are the various operations that you want to do in CSX or Java, and here are instructions which will be actually implemented by the underlying execution system that will do what the instruction specifies. So all we have to do is find valid Java instructions that already exist, translate our CSX into a series of those, and turn it loose. And we're guaranteed that the program will do exactly as the programmer specified. Sounds too good to be true, but actually, that means a lot of the heavy lifting has been done by the people who developed Java. They've done some good work, and we're certainly going to build upon it. Another thing I'll mention in passing by doing these techniques is it's possible to build systems that execute on a wide variety of platforms. And I think probably you're involved in this too. The days when all the programs people write run on mainframes or laptops or desktops is disappearing. And I don't know at all what your plans are, but I'm sure you must have applications that are tablet-oriented. It just seems like it's unavoidable that you wouldn't. And even smartphone-oriented. And who knows what comes after smartphones? It's a situation there where you think smartphones are about as small as they would get because they any smaller than that, you'd need real good vision to be able to read the screen. But maybe then it's not true. I'm starting to think that in future, the smartphones we have will be something that you've seen years and years ago. Anybody who ever saw Star Trek saw that they had these cool little badges that are communicators. Remember those little things that look like a little badge? And they talk into it and touch it and all that. That may be the destiny of what your smartphone is. Remember, it would be small enough that you can talk into it and talk out of it. From the sort of things you're doing, put enough smarts in there, and they may be able to tell you that you've been out too long, you're in danger of getting frostbite. That's if you stay in Madison or Verona. If you go someplace else, it may not be a problem. But it may be able to tell you that it's monitoring your blood pressure, and it's a little high, or monitoring your pulse, and you've been exercising like crazy, and it's time to go down the cool-down phase. So the packages these things are in will change. But what happens is we're going to try to develop programs that allow us to have different compilers for different packages and be able to access the packages correctly. And that's going to be some really cool work there. For example, a lot of the stuff that we now print out, if we actually have this little badge-type communicator, that will come out as oral or perhaps come out as some sort of signal, sort of like a buzzing smartphone now. Or maybe instead of saying something to you, it would give you a sound, like a dog growling or something. Give you time. It's time to stop doing something because the dog is growling, saying, bad person, bad. Lots of wild ideas, but they're only wild because we haven't done them as yet. I won't have time to do all of them. Many of you will. And you can say, way back when, I know the guy who told me about doing that, and nobody will believe you, but it's still cool to say. Okay, I promised that we get into symbol tables because this is one of the things you actually have to implement. And a lot of people very naturally have questions about, well, okay, he said symbol table, but what does he mean and how do I implement it? So I wanted to be sure to get into that. And The first, we have two things to do. First of all, is say, logically, what does the symbol table do? And not only will we do a symbol table, we'll do a block structured symbol table. And that's because we will have not just one table representing one scope, that's the old languages did that, but we'll have multiple tables representing multiple scopes. It's not that hard an extension, but it is something we need to do. So we'll have to understand what the tables do, what we want them to do, and then I'll talk a little bit about how they're implemented, although Java has some excellent implementations that we just take off the shelf and have faith that they do work. But it's still something to understand what's going on. So logically, what you have to decide early on is all a table is a way to map a key, that's usually a single piece of information, into an output, which can be a complex piece of information. That usually means it's a class object. So for your purposes, the symbol table remember, it's going to store information about identifiers, which are strings. So it's going to take a string and map it into the object that you're creating information about. Let's call it an ID info. Remember, that's the thing that says, my name is so-and-so, my line number is so-and-so, my type is so-and-so, and here's a link to a list of zero or more users of my identifier. So we'll call this to some sort of object, and I'll call it an ID info. The reason we need that is that the ID info is created at declaration points, but it's accessed and updated at all uses. So if I, at some point I hear, have here and say, A gets one, and that's part of a statement. He's saying, hey, I looked at the left-hand side of an assignment, and that can be an identifier. So inside the AST node, if I happen to have an identifier, I'm going to have a call that says, something happened about an identifier. Now, what do I know? Well, duh, I know that's identifier A. And I know by the rules that identifiers must be declared properly. We haven't quite gotten to yet, but we actually have the rule that identifiers must be declared before they are used. Not all languages do that, but most languages these days do. There are a couple places where they loosen the rules a bit. But the reason for that is, imagine you're a person reading a program, and you see a reference to A without seeing any definition for it. You don't know what A means. Now, that's not as much of a limitation as it used to be, because if you have something like Eclipse, you can click on it and it says, please show me the declaration, and it'll show it to you. So whether it's before or after is not good, and not as important, but having a declaration come first seems to be good. So you say, okay, find me the ID info associated with A, because I have to update it. What am I going to do? Well, this guy has a line number. So let's say this is at line 17. So say, I've got to go to the ID info for A and record the fact there's a usage of A at line 17. So how do I do that? I say, okay, let's take my symbol table. It maps a string. A is a string. So I feed that into the lookup mechanism and says, please give me the corresponding ID info. If we have only one scope, it's got to be there. If we have multiple scopes, it'll search from innermost to outermost until it finds one. And again, we're assuming that it's valid, so there's no problem saying, hey, nobody declared A, I don't know what to do. That's extra credit, and you'll be able to find out what to do, or you can kind of ask me and I'll kind of give you some hints. So it looks up the ID info for the spot where the correct A was declared, and it says, let's go into that structure. I've got that structure in my little hands now, and I can call a method. And one of the methods I could call is add usage or add use or whatever you want to call it. That would go into ID info, find that list of all the lines that used A, and append at the very end line 17. So I can say, please, for the ID info for A, add line 17 to my data. And I'll do this for each and every usage, accumulating all the information we have. So that's why we need a symbol table. Haven't gotten yet to how to implement it and some issues that come up. Some of them are easy, some are not so easy, but that's basically what we're going to be doing. So let's go ahead and run through all this. Excuse me, this is the time where the voice starts to peter out. That's better. So I did this last time, and it's time to redo it again and then get more deeply into the symbol table business. So here's an example of something where we have a line coming in the input. And remember, this is a single line. So as I said, this could be actually fed in as a sequence of characters. If you're a two-finger typist like me, you can imagine typing A blank equal blank, and each time I type that key, a character comes in. And this will be a sequence of characters. Typically, it's in a file, but there's no reason why I couldn't feed it in directly into the input of a compiler if I wanted to. It's not typically done because you edit in advance, proofread, and all that. But that's just a technical issue. It's not an impossibility. So we have the source line, and we're going to first call the scanner, and it's going to have rules that tell me where things begin and end. Notice not all the symbols are a single character long. Here's a case where BB is two characters, ABS is three characters. Sometimes a single character, sometimes not. Some characters are totally skipped. Like, for example, the blank here and here is going to be skipped. I could have squished that blank out, and it wouldn't have mattered. So what the scanner is going to do is group the characters, and yeah, it's in color. And I hope not too many of you are colorblind. So in this case, it's found out that the blue guy is a token, and it's an identifier. The equal is an operator called assignment. BB, even though it's two characters long, is an identifier. Plus is an operator, the plus operator. ABS is an identifier. Doesn't know yet that it's a function call. It just knows it's an identifier. The type checker will figure that out later. It sees a paren, and that's an L paren. It sees an identifier C. It sees a minus sign. It sees the digit 7, which is an integer literal. Literally, it's the number 7, and produces this sequence of tokens. Each one of those can be thought of as a different class. The subscript could be thought as a field inside the class, differentiating various identifiers. So it says, I'm identifier A, assignment, all assignments are the same, identifier B plus, identifier ABS, left paren, identifier C, and the line continues on, I just broke it, minus int literal 7, right paren semi. This is still pretty unreadable, but at least it's the fact that now I have individual characters gone and groups of characters grouped together properly. It then goes ahead and says, hey, let's go ahead and parse and put this guy into a structure if it's a valid program. So interestingly, even though this begins with an identifier, it's able to say identifier isn't the key feature of this particular statement. It's the fact that it's an assignment. And it's actually the second character that told me that. So it was able by the parser to say, maybe the equal should have come first. But that's not the way people write things. They always write something equals something, mimicking mathematics and science and engineering. So we'll put it in the middle. But the key feature, if I look at this just as a human being who's programmed, I'd say, that's not an A statement. That's an assignment statement because this little assignment guy is really what controls the meaning of the structure. So it says, okay, here's a tree, and the main thing about this tree is it's an assignment. It knows that all assignment statements have two components, and left-hand side, which is the target, and the right-hand side, which is the source. And as I argued earlier, maybe they should have been reversed, but it's too late to change it. Sometimes decisions are made, and you are stuck with them. So as the assignment is usually a variable, a good example of a variable is an identifier. Identifiers have a name A. So inside the tree, it says, I'm an ident node. Look up the definition of an ident node. ID is identifier. And its name is A. It says, hey, generally I assign an expression. So let's go back and say, this expression has a lot of junk in it. What's the key feature? Well, the rules of the language say, in this particular case, you have two components, BB and ABS, which is the value of a function call, and those are the two guys to be added together. So the key operation is a plus, and plus is binary. So it says, hey, I'm a plus, and my left operand is an identifier named BB. The right identifier is an expression. What is it? Well, it's not a trivial expression, it's a call. Calls appear a lot, but they're a little more complex. A call is something that has a name of a method that you call it, in this case, ABS, and it has zero or more parameters. In this case, it has one parameter. It's an expression. What expression? It's a minus, a subtraction. The left operand is C. The right operand is an int literal. And I should have put subscript 7 on there. It may have gotten squished away. But if you have paper or something and you want to be very precise, that should have a 7 on there to differentiate that. But I get a question. Earlier on, I had parentheses on a semicolon. I don't see those in my tree. And the question is why? That's right. It's situation. Those aren't needed for the meaning of a program. They were there for readership. Going back, notice that the reason I need parens is to show what the extent of that operation, where that expression was. But the subtree tells me that. The extent is whatever the subtree is. So I don't need that. What about semicolon? That's just a way of telling the compiler, this statement is done. There'll be another one that might follow it. But okay, it's done. And now I know where the end of it is. You don't have to tell me that. So it turns out some programming languages don't require a semicolon. They'll let an end of line act as a semicolon. That's a nice improvement in many cases, but it means that you have to have one line per statement. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. If you have an extra line, extra long line, it may be unattractive, but it's still doable. So in our language, we say a semicolon will tell us when the statement is over, but when we get to the tree, it doesn't matter anymore. So this thing contains the meat of what I wrote down. And you say, oh, that's a tree. That's kind of unreadable. It is, and yet it isn't, because it contains all the key information just where I want it. If at some point I say, I've got to check whether or not this assignment is valid, that means I've got to look at the target. Hey, it's sitting right there. And I've got to look at the source sitting right there. I have to do some analysis, but it's putting all the data exactly where I want to find it. So the flexibility that was in the source program is now gone. It's a very rigid format, but also a format that's very reliable. So it's not really meant for humans to read, but it is meant for compiler writers like us to understand and appreciate. So this is really quite a good format for our purposes. I still don't know whether this makes sense or not. Remember this notion about Harry likes Java. That might make sense or might not, depending on what Harry means and what Java means. So in this case, we're going to do something called a type checker. The way a type checker works is it works down to the bottom of a program at individual leaves, figures out what they mean. Figures out what they mean by, for example, checking the symbol table, or if it's a literal, checking what kind of literal it is. So it works its way down the tree, and the reason is it works down the tree is because intermediate nodes are valid depending on what the valid nature of the subtrees is. So it says, let's look up C in a symbol table. We'll get more to that. It says, what am I? I'm an integer, and I'm also location, a loc. That kind of means I'm a variable. I have a memory location assigned with me. Remember, there are some identifiers that don't have a location, for example, named constants. If I had something named pi, it may be a floating point number 3.14159, blah, 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 blah. That does not need necessarily to have a location. It's got a value, and I can plug in its value as a substitute for its name. So not all identifiers are locations. Oh, now my inert literal 7 came back. Well, good. I made my mistake. And it says, well, what's the type of integer literal? Duh, it's integers. So I come up a level, I type check my children, I come up to me and say, well, I'm a minus. What do I have if my left child's an integer and my right child's an integer? And the answer is a value that's an integer. So I tag myself as integer. This seems kind of boring, but remember in Java, you have floating point. In the case of plus, you might have strings. String plus string is string in Java. So there's checking is non-trivial. It says, I have a call, and what about a call? Well, the left thing I call has to be a method. So I look up in the symbol table and say, yeah, there's a method pre-declared in the math package, I guess it is, called ABS. Actually, it turns out that guy is overloaded. I can take the absolute number of an integer. I can take the absolute of a floating point, and it's able to figure out which of those two I want. This is a case of overloading being resolved. So it says, I'm a call. Here's a method, and I have two definitions. I don't know which exact one is there, but I have a single operand called an integer. And the rule is, in overloading, if the operand's an integer, the result's an integer. If the operand's floating, the result is floating. So it says, okay, I'm an integer. It says, okay, plus your left operand is integer location. Integer plus integer is integer. I'm an assignment, and it says, I'm assigning an integer to an integer location. That's fine. No type conversions or castings are needed. And it says, by the way, this was an integer assign. The reason I tag that is it might be the code I generate for an integer assign is different than the code I generate for a floating point or for a string or something else. So I say, of all the kinds of assigns I might do, I'm doing an integer assignment. Finally, I generate code, and I went through this last time. I'm doing it again because this looks very foreign. Don't let that bother you because you haven't seen the Java virtual machine. But it's an important thing to say that if I go back to my tree, I can go down this tree, and for each of these particular nodes, generate a little bit of code that actually implements the manipulation of this stuff. So think of this as being walked from the bottom of the tree up. Why is that? Well, normally you evaluate operands before you apply operators. So the bottom part has to be evaluated before the top part can do its thing. So one of the things I'll do is there's an instruction called I for integer load, load from memory. This is fetching from memory where, well, each variable is given not a name, because names don't matter anymore. They're given a number. And what all that happens is the first variable I declare gets number one. The second one gets number two and is very boring, but very predictable and uniform. So in this particular case, this is variable three. Turns out that A, I guess, was one and C was two. Just the order in which they declared. So it says, please load from integer three, variable three, which happens to be named BB. How could I tell that? Well, in the symbol table, when I looked up BB, I said, what location did I give to him? I gave him location three. So it says, let's go ahead and do that. The net effect will be to push that onto an operand stack. So we'll start out with a stack. An operand stack is simply a visualization of how data are stored as the computation proceeds. Each instruction will manipulate the stack. The stack has a bottom and a top. Stuff comes in on the top and goes out at the top. So it pushes local three, and what it's doing is putting the value of BB. So I don't have characters BB anymore. I've looked it up from memory, and there's some number, 1, 2, 3, or whatever it is. The value of that is on the stack. Stacks can have guys pushed on top of them. That's why they're stacks. So the next thing says, I've got to have operand C, and what's happening about that? That's at position two. So that will push the value of C onto the stack. I haven't gotten around to using them. Let's go back and say, why did I do those sort of things there? Well, the situation there is that I have the value of BB because I saw this call, and I have the value of C because I saw that identifier. Notice I'm not going to be using the BB up there yet. But I saw it because I visited the left operand and then the right operand. So just sitting there waiting, and we'll need it eventually. So the next thing I see is the integer literal 7. There's an instruction called load constant. That pushes onto the stack a constant value 7. So I'll show you the actual 7. So at this stage, having executed three instructions, I haven't computed anything yet, but I've set something up. And this may seem dull, but I'm actually putting things in just the right location so when I need them, they're going to be at hand. So the next thing I do is do a subtraction. And subtraction always operates on the top two operands. The top operand is the right. The next to the top is the left. And it says do a subtraction of an integer. So it takes the top two values, C and 7, throws those away, and computes C minus 7, again, as an integer. It then goes ahead and says, well, wait a minute, that's the operand to a call, so I've got to go ahead and call an external subroutine. It means I've got to figure out where it is, and there's an exact notation. It says, this guy is given a location. Think of it as in a file structure that says, here's where to find the code for each of the predefined methods. So this thing is Java, and it's in the subpackage language, subpackage math, and it's a method called ABS. What are these I's? Well, I told you the thing is overloaded, so there's a version that says I for integer. It says, here's my result. My operand is I, and my result follows rather than precedes the name. It says, I'll take an integer in and give you an integer out. That's the guy I want. It says, please go and find this guy. So the runtime system scoots through and says, hey, here's the code I want you to execute. I want you to execute using that stack. So it goes ahead and finds C minus 7, which might be a plus or a minus value, and returns the absolute value. If it's plus, it's unchanged. If it's minus, the sign is essentially stripped. So it comes here is the ABS of C minus 7. And again, that's just the number that that expression represents symbolically. So it says, okay, there's that. And it says, well, wait a minute. I have BB sitting on the stack way at the bottom, except not so far at the bottom. And since I've got to do an addition, that gives me BB plus ABS of C minus 7. And I'm almost done. It says, let's do a store. Store what? what's at the top of the stack, where, into local variable one, which is A. So it removes this guy from the stack, goes into memory wherever that variable A's location is, and updates it. So the code, step by step by step, is actually implemented what your CSX instruction asked it to do. So we'll get back to that. But at this stage, you can say, well, it kind of makes sense. If I pick out the right translation on a step-by-step basis, I'll be able to take any tree I want, evaluate it, and get an actual answer in a computer memory somewhere where I can use it. Now I can get to symbol tables. Let's see how we're doing on time. Cool. Got enough time to get started into that. So symbol tables and scoping I wanted to get to early because this is something you got to do in the next couple of weeks. So symbol tables map identifiers to information about them. What's in the information? Anything you care to put in there. For our case, we've talked about what's needed. Scoping represents the fact that in current languages, not all declarations range the entire scope of a program. So we'll have subtables representing local declarations and bigger tables representing containing information, and we'll use one or the other depending on which one is the most current scope. So at the start of a scope, the symbol table is entry. So at the very beginning of a program, let's go ahead and do that. So I see, starting out, you're going to be at the root of the CSX node, and you're going to need a symbol table. So every time I see a left brace or the AST node associated with left brace, that's either a CSX light node or a block node, it says I need a new symbol table because there's a new scope. So it's going to say right there, open up a symbol table that's initially empty. So you do a new and create whatever symbol table data structure you use. I suggest a hash table. You don't need to, but it's there. It's very flexible, very efficient. Why not use it? So this is empty right at this stage. I now go down to the declaration. I enter information for A, namely it's an int, and line number two, but let's not worry about line number. That's the key information. I then see another brace and say, hey, I have a new scope. So I open up a new scope, and this is logically linked because the inner scope is always checked before the outer scope. So the rule is look at this guy and then that guy. At this stage, that's exactly what I have. Find a declaration, it goes into the inner scope. So it says B is a bool, and see a brace here. It says, hey, he's opening up another scope. A block may appear within a block. So I have another scope opened up, and it's initially empty. I then go ahead and say, well, I have C, which is an integer. And let's put a statement here, B equals false. So it sees B and says, hey, I got to figure out which declaration you mean. Well, I'm inside the scope with C in it, so I first look up in this innermost table. Do you have a B? The answer is no, I do not. Check the next one. It says, do you have a B? It says, yes, I do. So that's the closest definition of a B, and it says, I'm a bool. So that's fine, and I'll use that information. I then see false. What do I do about false in terms of the symbol table? Gotcha. You must be napping. False is not in the symbol table, probably. In most languages, false and true are reserved words. They're reserved words. They don't go in the symbol table. They are these things that look like identifiers but aren't identifiers. And if that's the case, if I have false as a reserved word, I don't have to worry about it. If false is not reserved, what happens is that there's, in many languages, an invisible containing scope that contains things like ABS that you don't declare but have access to. And the way you do that is you have an invisible, huge symbol table that is produced in advance. It says, here are all the identifiers the user may use, but he doesn't have to declare them. And that's simply an outer scope. And you inherit that when you start. And if none of your local definitions have definition of print, for example, I'll find it in this external scope there. Now, you're not going to have to implement it that way because we have a simpler language, but many languages do it that way, and it's not all that hard to make it all work. So let's go back to our electronic things. Something I haven't talked about yet, but something that we have to worry about, is whether I'm allowed to talk about an identifier before it's declared. In our language, CSX and CSX Lite, the answer is no. You must declare something before you can talk about it. Why? Well, that means I have complete information when I see a usage to decide what the user must mean. If he's talking about B, hey, that's a Boolean. If he's talking about A or C, those are integers. That kind of makes sense. Some languages allow you to have a declaration that comes later. It turns out that language like Java limits forward references to only members of classes in terms of fields and methods. And in those cases, you are allowed forward references. We're not going to have that generality. Question is, why would you have that? Well, there's something that absolutely mandates forward references, and that is mutually recursive methods. When you were learning about programming, you learned about recursion is cool. Later on, I'm going to show you something where we have mutual recursion. That means a method A might decide to call B, and a method B may decide to call A. Perfectly useful thing to have. But how do I program that if I don't have forward references? I got to write down the definition of A first or the definition of B first. No matter which way I do it, I'm going to be talking about somebody who's not declared yet. The guys who wrote Java were smart enough to know that's a potential problem. So they said, wait, let's wait a minute here, and we'll allow limited forward references. But normally languages do not allow forward references because you are talking about something you haven't seen. So it's rather much like if you're reading a mystery novel and there's a key element of the plot they haven't told you. They haven't told you, that the butler has a police record, and therefore everybody knows the butler did it. But if they would have told you he had a police record, you would have said, oh, of course the butler did it. So they don't tell you that till later. Maybe you go and see the guy's got a tattoo. Of course, it used to be in the old days only sailors and criminals had tattoos. Now it's everybody. In fact, it got so bad, I was kind of disappointed that in the old days, it's been around forever, that one of the toys you can buy a child is a Barbie doll. And you can still sell them. They're still made. But these days, if you buy a Barbie doll for whoever would want one, it comes with a sheet of decals. Why? Well, the person that's getting the Barbie doll might want to give Barbie tattoos. So the way you take Barbie and give it a tattoo is take a little decal and plug it on the arm or shoulder or who knows where that they might put it. So things have changed. But if, normally in the old days, if you had a tattoo, you were a sailor or a bad guy. But now, if you have tattoos, I'm not going to hold it against you. It's just common practice. So in this particular situation, what happens if a language allows forward references? It's possible to do. How does that change things? The way it changes is that when we traverse a tree, we have to traverse it twice. Once we traverse it to find all the declarations, which may be intermixed with uses, and then second time to process the uses. We don't have to do that, so you only have to traverse once. But if the language required it, we could, in fact, handle it. So I've made life easier for you there. You can thank me later. We're not going to have to do just symbol tables. We're going to have to do block-structured symbol tables. So let's talk a little bit about block-structured languages. Again, you probably learned this when you were learning programming, but it's still something I wanted to touch base on. This goes all the way back. Once upon a time, people actually named languages for the year in which they were proposed. So ALGO 60 goes all the way back to 1960, which, my gosh, is 50 years plus. C goes back to the 1970s, I guess, C++ to the 1980s, Java to the 2000s, and CSX to the 2000s. So what happens is you may have a series of nested structures, and scopes may nest, and normally the nearest or closest definition is the one that applies. And when you add new declarations, they always apply to the innermost current scope. Now, again, you know that, but I wanted to just revisit that. Also, here's a case where I had some nice colors, so I thought I'd show those off just to help you figure out what a symbol table, block structure symbol table, would do. So it would first say, hey, here's X and Z. Let's put those in the current scope. I would then go down and find method A, or procedure A, depending on what you call it. This brace opens a scope. So the body of a method is a local scope. You've learned that probably, and it's true. So here I have X. That's a redefinition. It's perfectly valid. Y is a brand new variable. That's fine. Let's assume print is a reserved word. And let's figure out what the symbol table tells us about X, Y, and Z. It looks up X. There's a local variable. So it says, hey, X is local. So it's a float. Let's look up Y. It's a local, so it's a float. Let's look up Z. There's no local Z, but there's a containing Z, so it's an integer. So it says, let's do a print of a float, and an integer. I then get out of A, see the close brace. That means the scope ends. The symbol table containing the float Y and X is gone. I can no longer access it. I go into B and say, hey, here's another print. What about X? Well, in this case, there's no local definition for X. So it goes to the global one and says X is an integer. What about Y? In this case, hey, he's undeclared. I got to print out an error message. And what about Z? He's global, and therefore he's an int. Okay, that's cool. Something they never tell you, but something we're going to learn about in answer, is there are certain cases where the location of an identifier is a little bit ambiguous. And sometimes you have to put sort of scientific reasoning behind something to figure out where a definition goes. And in particular, I'm talking about A and B. Those are identifiers. And method A and method B are opening the scope. Does A go into the local scope that A controls, or does it go into the outer scope on the same level as X and Z? There's two possibilities. You say, ooh, I'm not sure which. But you can figure it out by using a plausibility test. Try one, could it work? Try the other, could it work? In particular, suppose A was defined in its own scope. Can anybody notice anything bad about that? You're never going to be able to use it. How could I call it? It's like something going into a black hole. You know, if you get close enough to a black hole, they say it sucks in everything, and you can never get out. Light can never get out. You can never have a rocket motor powerful enough to get you out. Once you're in forever. And that sounds suspiciously like a bad place that I learned about when I was going to Sunday school, so I'm going to stay away from black holes. So it can't be the case that A goes into its own scope because nobody would ever be able to use it. Why define a method nobody could ever use? So the answer is, it looks a little bit odd, but when you're doing scoping for a method, and you'll actually have to do this a little later on in the semester, A is in the current scope. I'm not showing any parameters, but if I have parameters, they go into the local scope because it's the case that they're accessible only locally and all local definitions are local. So you have to open the scope at just the right point and close it at just the right point. Similarly for B, B is in the global scope, but its parameters, which we don't have any, and its locals, which we don't have any, would be in a local scope. And that's just a plausibility issue, but something which will come up later on, and I'll kind of talk you through how it works. So what are the block structure concepts? Nested visibility. There's no access to identifiers outside their scope. So there's no way saying, I'm an outsider, please give me access to the variable inside method A or method B. Reason for that is the variables belong to method A or B may not even exist yet. We haven't gotten to that yet, but compilers are very clever. If you have local variables in a method, it doesn't even create those variables until the method is called. Why is that? Well, just think of a program that has hundreds, maybe thousands of methods. Why should you have all the data for all those methods just sitting around when it's not being used? Rather, it's a situation where when you decide you need something, you order it and say, hey, I'm going to call method M, give me space for its variables. I'm leaving method M. Throw away space for its variables. And although I won't show it today, that's a way to allow recursion to work. If you ever wondered how it's the case that factorial calls factorial calls factorial calls factorial, and they don't step on each other's data, the reason is each call creates a new block of data. Each return frees it. So if factorial calls itself over and over, each call gets brand new data. And because it's brand new data, it's protected from all the other guys. So recursion works very easily, and if you love recursion, that's very good because recursion will work properly. Use static nesting of scopes, and here's what I was just talking about a moment ago. The lifetime of data objects is bound to the scope in which they're created. If a scope is closed, the data may be released if you care to. Some languages have little tweaks on that. For example, in C and C++, you can make something static. What static means is it lives across calls, and that means you simply translate a static variable slightly differently than a local variable. Something I haven't talked about, but something where you're actually going to have to do a little programming cleverness. But you're all clever, so that's no problem. Namely, all languages have this question. Is the case of an identifier significant? All that means is if I intermix upper and lower case, does it change the meaning of identifier? This is one of those things where different languages have different rules. So, for example, in C, C++, and Java, and many other languages, I think perhaps the majority, case is significant. Why is that good? That means you're going to have two identifiers that are very similar in name that have different definitions, like little double A and capital double A. The trouble is, in many human languages, when you say a name, it doesn't signify the case. So, you know, you go to your partner and say, what variable are you using to hold this? You say double A. But that's not enough necessarily, because there's a lower double A and a capital double A, and just saying it does not tell you enough. So because of that, some languages like Pascal, Ada, Scheme, and CSX, I'm doing it just to make life miserable for you a little bit. Case is not significant. That means double A and capital A mean the same thing. Well, so what? Here's so what. Suppose you're doing your symbol table, and you're not clever, and you don't remember my warning. And I do something like int AA, and B gets AA. No big deal. But remember how we went ahead and stored identifiers. We have an entry in a symbol table that maps AA to the fact that it's an int. But when I go ahead and look up a string, the string double A capital and the string lower double A lowercase is not the same string. So if I'm not careful and I look up double A, it's going to tell me, hey, that's not declared, because double A lowercase and double A uppercase is different. You know that if you do a string compare and say, are they equal? The answer is no. But for our purposes, they're functionally equal. So what we'll do is something called case stripping. And let's see, do I have that on the next slide? Yeah, right here. So what you do is when you enter something in a symbol table, you strip case. All that means is that you take case and make it uniform. I recommend either uniformly lowercase or uniformly uppercase. There is, by the way, a method in class string that does that for you, so you don't even have to bother program it. So what happens is when I enter double A, let's suppose I strip it to uppercase. So the entry is in here, but when I look something up, I say, I'm going to go ahead and convert that to uppercase, do the lookup in uppercase, and get that definition. So the suggestion is strip case when you do lookup and entry, store the entry in the symbol table by the case in which the user defined it. So if the user said, hey, I love double A in capitals, if I print out an error message or print out a listing or something like that, I'll show you double A. So that's something you will have to make work. It's not a big deal, but it's enough just to mess you up if you're not staying alert. See how we're doing time-wise. Do I have enough time to get into that? No, we're down to just a small amount of time. Let's take our second break, and I'll talk a little bit about implementation, and then we'll talk a little bit more about hash tables, and finally, a little bit about scanning, and then you'll be out of here. So it's just about quarter of, so let's go ahead and restart a few minutes before 8. And I'll actually get you out of here a few minutes before 8:30.